All right, it's on.
Okay. Well, welcome everyone to the January 23rd, 2020 regular meeting of the North Penn Planning Commission. I'm Scott Greenberg. I am vice chair. Acting as chair tonight, so this is Gary Howell's speaker tonight. So the first thing we have is roll call. So I'll just go around the table and say your name.
Judy Malaya.
Scott Greenberg.
Olivia Lowe.
James Bovers.
Mayor McFarland.
Monty Lindell, City Attorney.
Mark Regal, City North Bend Public Works Director.
Brian Tucker, Public Works Project Manager.
And Mike McCarty, City Planner.
And Susan Torkison should be coming tonight, correct? She hasn't.
I haven't heard otherwise.
Okay. So Susan will probably be here a bit later. At this point, why don't we have the mayor do his introduction and greeting, and then maybe we, the commissioners, can all introduce ourselves to each other.
Either direction you want to do it, but I'm happy to step in. I'm just coming for a few minutes. I wanted to come and welcome the new members, number one, and also say I think you're going to have a great year, and thank you all for serving again. You've got an incredible staff, not only here at the table, but a lot more people behind there here to help you. You'll get to know Heather particularly. You'll get to know many of them that you don't. You're at a little disadvantage in this room since some of the others are more knowledgeable from having been involved in other things. But and you also have a really good chair, despite the fact that he didn't show up tonight. And so he's great, and Scott does a great job pinch-hitting for him when he's not, so mention that. I wanted to come primarily for that welcome, give you an opportunity, if you had any kind of overarching questions from your role as a planning commission, to ask it before the city attorney scares the wits out of you with the legalese. And also to convey to you that understand that one of my top goals in coming into my role is to get a more robust dialogue going between and among the commissions as well as with the council. And so I've talked to staff about that. They've got their own ideas that they've come to me with, you know, before I ask for it. Council likewise has that same feeling, and you should know that, is that several council members have approached me with the same goal, that they want a better dialogue going back and forth so that you better understand council's goals as well as they understanding the thinking that you're putting into your work. And so that's one of my most important missions there. And speaking of which, I'll just make you aware there'll be more coming out, and in fact, Mike may have more for you tonight, I'm not sure. The city's annual retreat is going to be February 12th. That is a council retreat predominantly. It is a public meeting. You'll get a more specific invite from either myself or Dave Miller. With kind of the agenda that we're looking at, but land use is one of the largest topics on there, and so if you had time during your day to pop in and get a little flavor of that, you'll get a chance to hear council's thinking, council's direction, where they're kind of hitting the guiding for the year, and that will be coming in the form of different things that come before you this year. So I wanted you to kind of have that opportunity. So there's going to be more on that. That's really the sum total of what I wanted to share with you beyond thank you. So questions or anything for me, otherwise, whatever you want.
Feel like you're back home?
Kind of. Yeah, for me, all they did was change the name on the bottom. And you could just be planning commissioner. It'd be fine.
So let's go back and have each commissioner maybe, you know, 30 seconds to a minute, go quickly, close to who you are and what your interests are, maybe where are you from, in what kind of area.
Hi everyone, voluntary stewardship program coordinator, implementing these voluntary plans. I'm at Ecology, and I'm currently the National Estuary Program Manager, also at Ecology. So, a little bit of a environmental background. I'm really happy to be here.
Okay, Dave Bovers. I've been on the commission since May 2018, that's when I started. I moved to North Bend in 2010, so I've been here since then. I live up in Wilder's Rim, outside of Sydney, but that's about it. It's my background, I have a geography degree, so I did planning classes in college, and kind of got me interested in this, and came in to a meeting for work, and we had our own company had a custom to go through the planning commission, and got an introduction to what it was from going through there and watching the meeting, and decided to join up.
My name is Olivia Moe. I have lived here in North Bend since 2011. Before that, I have lived in Bellevue for almost 20 years. I got interested in this last May. I started coming to a lot of different meetings, and
I'm Jen Palayo, and I'm coming to the Planning Commission from working with Mike in the Common Parks Commission. I think I probably was there for at least a term and a half, and enjoyed every single second of it. And so now I've decided to try this commission. I don't know anything about this. I'm reading my stuff. Sorts of alphabets, soup stuff. So anyway, here I go on this one. I'm delighted to serve here. I've lived in North Bend. I grew up in North Bend. I have to confess, I grew up here. And I couldn't wait to get out of here when I graduated from high school. This one, I lived in a small town in the USA. Everybody knew everything. So, but I came back. So, I always have been a property owner out here for many, many years. And I've seen a lot of changes.
I'm Scott Greenberg. I've been here in North Bend since 2014. Joined the Planning Commission at the same time that James did in 2018. Right after I joined the Planning Commission, I retired from my career as a city planner. I was the planning director essentially for First Rhode Island and then Burien before that. I worked for a number of east side cities. Also served on the Issaquah Planning Commission, the Issaquah City Council when I lived there. I was on the Redmond Design Commission for a couple of years. So I've been involved in a lot of civic activities that way. I was involved with ARCH, Regional Coalition for Housing, because everything but our staff is depends on all different levels. And so that's kind of passion on professional. And now we live in the Silver Creek neighborhood, just outside the city limits. And from my house there, about a mile.
Look at that. The thing, and I thought I knew you. I just learned two new things. That's cool.
Are you out of here?
I'm pretty much out of here.
Okay.
All yours.
All right. Well, I was going to say I would never correct my new mayor, but I am not here to scare you. That's one for me on the board, boss. So what we're doing tonight is we're going to do, is it okay, Chair, to go ahead with the training? Or?
Actually, I think there's a few other things on
the okay, all right.
Should be relatively quick, if that's okay.
Sure.
So item 3 on the agenda is an opportunity for public comment. Anybody?
Mike Thomas, 1231 the Forest Drive to see. I actually have a really question for the community board. We'll be taking public comments on item 7 out of that discussion that
I would say probably not, just since it's an introduction. If you have anything to say, maybe.
Before I say it now, or should I say it?
Actually, you know what? Since we don't have a large crowd, let's have you wait until then. So
okay.
You
know, thank you. I just want to remind you.
Until we've had our introduction, and then you can at some point. Yeah.
I was noticed in the past planning commissions, sometimes pretend to public comment before an item is introduced is lost.
Yeah.
It's important to get comments on the record. So
I agree. Yeah.
That was my one comment. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. official business is approval of agenda and consent agenda, but there's no consent agenda.
Yeah, I want to just offer a clarification on that too. Yes. So you guys haven't seen the existing planning commission coming back, haven't seen that before. So I met with the chair, Gary Tao, and Mayor Rob to talk about kind of future structure of the planning commission. And this was a suggestion that we bring back any items that you deliberated on following a public hearing, that you not take action that same night, just so they have a little bit more time to contemplate comments that were received, go over whatever other edits, and see a clean version of that final document before you take action. So the idea there is that we come back on a consent agenda, which means an agenda that you're not getting into, diving into the weeds on. It's just there for your approval. You can take it off the consent agenda if you want to then debate it, or you can approve it on the consent agenda.
Which is similar to how the city council operates.
Right. One just technical question, and if you don't have an answer, that's fine. Do we need to add anything to our bylaws that have a consent agenda added to the agenda?
You'll have to look and see if they're that specific. I mean, unfortunately, your bylaws are incredibly specific. I don't want you guys to waste a lot of time going over them, but I would have had them much more simplified. They're quite specific, and they, you know, but I would look at that, just see what it says about the agenda.
Yeah.
We have to make a couple housekeeping amendments anyway, because it refers to Old City Hall, puts the address in, which, you know, that's why I mean by overly specific.
Is the idea with the consent agenda, when we do have something like that, is the idea to do that kind of like a minutes approval, kick it off from the beginning, say,
right,
here it is, you read it ahead of time, everyone's seen it.
Every time you get a chance to see the final product without any kind of handwritten edits during the meeting or whatnot.
Right.
Okay. All right. So is there a motion for approval of tonight's agenda?
Motion to approve.
Moved by Commissioner Boker, seconded by Commissioner Moe. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Okay. Passes. All right. All right, so the next item is approval of minutes of the November 14th Planning Commission meeting. This is agenda item number 5. Very motion to approve the minutes.
As I mentioned earlier, this is not to scare you. This is actually a training that's required by state law that we provide for you. Mike has given me 20 minutes, so I'm going to go very quickly. I didn't put anything in your packet for a very intentional reason. You have a lot of reading to do. You have a really smart staff, and after we've kind of gone over this overview, if you have questions, don't hesitate to ask Mike, and if it's a legal question, he'll forward it to me and we'll get it answered for you. But generally, you know, I've been practicing law almost 40 years. I've never seen a planning commissioner named in a lawsuit, involved in a lawsuit, so I don't mean this to scare you in any way. So there are a couple state statutes which impact how you guys do business. The first one is you guys are a body that got created by a state statute, and the Planning Commission is a group that provides recommendations on land use regulations to the City Council. You recommend whether they should approve it. You recommend the text of the legislation. I'll give you a brief overview. What I'm going to try and touch on are two other state statutes. One's called the Open Public Meetings Act, which talks about how you operate. Another one is called the Public Records Act. And then I'm going to have you drill back to some of your basic government and civics learning, and we're going to talk a little bit about separation of powers. So let's start with that. And as you all know, and we all learned this, I think it was in eighth grade, there's three branches of government. There's the legislative, the judicial, and the executive. The executive is the mayor. You guys are primarily sitting in a legislative capacity, and there's certain rules that apply when you're sitting as like your Congress, like legislators, sometimes, not as regularly as you do sit in a legislative capacity, you could sit in what's called a quasi-judicial capacity. And the easy way to think about that is, if you're making a decision about a specific person, as opposed to an area-wide regulation, so each year your citizens can make an application to rezone their property. Okay, so that'd be a specific person. Let's say Olivia wasn't on the commission, and Commissioner Moe came forward and said, hey, I want to rezone my house from single-family residential to multifamily. That's a specific party that is bringing that action, as opposed to you guys are looking at an area-wide regulation. You know, we're all talking about affordable housing. You might look at a tiny homes, you know, land use regulation that could impact all residential zones. If you did that, that's an area-wide regulation, and you'd be sitting in a legislative capacity. So your staff will tell you when you're sitting in a quasi-judicial capacity, and they'll probably give the chair over the script to read, and it'll go something like that. It'll say, we need to know whether or not you have any conflict of interest before you vote on this, because you might have to recuse yourself. If you have a financial interest or if you have a remote interest, maybe you sit on a board of the person that's making the application. But you'll be asked questions to see whether or not you have a conflict of interest. The other rule that comes up when you're sitting quasi-judicial is something that prohibits ex parte communications. And what that means are, you know, just as you wouldn't want a judge having conversations about your matter outside of the courtroom, you can't have any conversations about this matter outside of this room. Okay, that's called an ex parte communication. And you might be required to put that on the record before you vote on it. So that's really, you have a lot more flexibility in a legislative capacity. Go talk to all your neighbors and find out what the citizens think. We want you to do that. You're representing the citizens. It's totally fine to have those conversations. Hey, we're looking at a tiny homes regulation. What do you guys think about it? That's an ex parte communication. It's totally fine to have those when you're looking at a piece of legislation. Okay, so that's kind of the separation of, yeah?
On that same topic, how does that work when we make an area-wide decision for an individual parcel that not somebody to bring it to us?
So if you're just rezoning one lot because a person has made an application on that zone, it's not an area-wide rezone. You are just, now if you are making, let's say you're rezoning all of one of our residential zones to allow cottage, let's just use the tiny homes example, to allow tiny homes on lots greater than 10,000 square feet, and somebody had been advocating for it because they're going to do it on their parcel, it's still an area-wide rezone. It's not quasi-judicial.
So I'm thinking more specifically on the calendar, we do have one that I noticed was a rezoning of a general idea, but it was only affecting one or two parcels.
But they aren't making the application. It's the city that's doing it. So they're exercising their land use authority, and I would say, no, in that instance, it's more than one lot. It's not their application. So, and when they come up, like I said, you're not going to be expected to know, am I sitting in a quasi-judicial capacity? Am I sitting in a legislative? Your staff will actually read a little script and say, okay, this is quasi-judicial. The next act I want you to know about is something called the Open Public Meetings Act, or bureaucrat geeks like us call it the OPMA because we love acronyms. So you'll hear people talk about the OPMA all the time. And the reason this legislation was adopted is because the citizens have a right to transparency and the ability to see how you guys think, how you come up with your decisions. And so, you know, the first question might be, well, I get that when the council is adopting a regulation, but why should it cover us also? Well, the state law is pretty clear that if the council has created a commission to act on its behalf, to accept public testimony, which you will have today, and to take that into consideration, you actually are standing in the council's shoes, and you're subject to the same rules that they are. So what does the OPMA require? First, it says all your meetings must be open. And you probably think, well, that's pretty easy. The door's open. We notify it. It's open. What's tricky is you can actually have a meeting and not know it. And that's where we can run afoul of the OPMA. And let me explain some examples of how that might occur. There's lots of case law that's come out of this legislation. It's primarily around emails and what I would call, you know, kind of the phone tree phenomena. So let's say Judy has a great idea. Let's use the tiny home example. Let's say Judy found a great code down in California, and she said, She sends it out to all of her commissioners. I'm not picking on you, but she sends it out to all her commissioners. Says, "Hey, take a look at this. We're taking up, tiny homes next month." I thought this was really cool. Do you think that would violate the OPMA?
No, not if there's not a response. Exactly.
Good one. Perfect. Well, here's somebody who sat on the planning commission for a while. You guys get to share information with one another. But I would say as soon as you send that email out and you've copied all of your commission members, one of the things I used to do with the council is if I was sending them something, I would say, this is for information purposes all. Information purposes only. Do not reply all. Because somebody might even just reply all and go, hey, this looks great. Let's consider this next month. Does that violate the OPMA? Scott, my old timer, yes, it does. Why does it? Because the OPMA says your discussion and debate has to occur in a public setting. There's just been discussion about the tiny home ordinance that's been on email, okay? And you can't get around it. There's this battleground case where one elected official sent it to another, and that elected official sent it to another and another. And once you reach a quorum, which is, there's seven?
Four.
Yeah, four. So once you reach a quorum, you've got a problem. You've created a meeting. Now, one or two of you can have those conversations, but again, I would encourage you to do as much as possible in the open setting so it's transparent. That doesn't mean I don't want you sharing good information with one another. You know, if you have information you want to share, share it, but just be careful. Don't hit reply all. Don't start debating it. Wait until you're in this room. If you want to have coffee with one of your commissioners, and even two, it's fine to do that. Just save the debate and discussion for in here. And if you talk about an ordinance and you have less than a quorum, less than those four, you're not violating the OPMA. But if you're sitting at a coffee shop with four of you and you're talking about that tiny house ordinance, you're violating the OPMA. So, yes?
Can I add something? So staff will email the packets out to us, and we're encouraged to review them ahead of time and send staff any questions we might have or suggest edits. One thing you might want to do is instead of hitting reply all or sending your comments individually to all the commissioners, send it to staff, and then it might then distribute it to all of us. It's not a violation.
Yeah. So it's better to send it to staff. Because and also you might come up with a change that you like and Judy goes, I don't really like that. I would rather do X, Y, or Olivia might do that. And it's really hard to control yourself not to say, hey Scott, good idea, but. So it's just better to send it to staff. So that's the OPMA. The other thing it prohibits is secret ballots. You'd never be in a position to do secret ballots, so you don't need to worry about that. Now, you know, you talk about, oh my God, what if we violate the OPMA? What are the consequences? The consequences are your action is invalid. All right, so you are required to make a recommendation up to the council. Let's say they adopted that ordinance. If it's invalid, then we never had a recommendation. We weren't in compliance with state law when the council adopted it, so we have to go all the way back, and then there's the chance that people that got permits, relying on that. So it's not a big fine. Nobody's going to jail. But there are consequences. So we really want to make sure we comply with it. And then the other thing I wanted to, the definition of what a meeting is, you know, when you read about, well, meetings have to be open, you think it's this, we're formally sitting around. It is so broad. It's any deliberation, discussion, any format. Now, there is an exception for social gatherings. I want to encourage you. I mean, if someone had a holiday party or a Halloween party and said, hey, I want to invite my PC commissioners, my planning commissioners, and you guys can do that. You can get together on a social level, but just don't have four of you talking about city business at those social gatherings, and you're totally exempt. We went over a couple examples. We talked about serial meetings or kind of, you know, the phone tree. Just sending it to one, and that, again, that if you hit the magic number four, you're in trouble. So it's just, again, better to do it in the session. So I'm sure you've heard of something called executive sessions. In the 7 years I was here, six and a half as city administrator, I only asked the Planning Commission to go into an executive session on one occasion. And there's numerous exceptions to the Open Public Meeting Act. The only two that might be applicable to this group would be pending or potential litigation. So let's say the city was being sued for some reason. You guys are getting ready to act on a code provision. And I'll give you an example. Moratoriums cannot be adopted indefinitely. And a moratorium is when you tell somebody you can't build on your land for some reason because the council is debating, deliberating, planning code amendments. And the example that I can give you is one I had here, is that we were unhappy with the first couple cottage developments that went up. Council said, that's not what we meant at all. So we put a moratorium in place for cottage housing until we could get the code right. You're only allowed to have a moratorium for 6 months, and then the council has to extend it for another 6 months. But if there's any testimony or statement that the reason for the moratorium is because we hate all cottage housing, we're trying to ban it, or the reason for the extension is because we just want to not allow the development to occur, it's illegal, and you can get sued. And we actually got sued. There was a group that had bought property while it was zoned for cottage housing, and they brought a lawsuit against the city. They actually walked away from it later, but we had to go into executive session and say, okay, now when you're talking about this code, here are some of the things we should say or shouldn't say. And that's really the only time I can imagine you end up in an executive session is potential or pending litigation. So, very rare, and you will have great representation and protection. The next one I'm going to briefly go over, and it really shouldn't impact you greatly, but there is something called the Public Records Act. And it is, again, part of the Sunshine Law, transparency. Citizens have a right to know how you guys are thinking, what you're doing when you're conducting city business. And I don't say this to scare you, but it doesn't really matter what device you're on. We've had some cases the last few years where it's primarily elected officials. Citizens recognize you guys are volunteers, you haven't been elected. Rarely have I seen anyone try and, create problems for commissioners. But if you're, like, on your computer, and I'll give you a City of Kirkland case. A council member was on his computer, sadly sexting with his girlfriend during a council meeting, and there was a request from a citizen under the Public Records Act asking for any of the, because he wasn't paying attention to what was going on. He's just like, and the citizen was upset that the elected official was on his computer and not paying attention to what was before him. And he asked for all of the communications and emails and anything that he was doing during that council meeting time period. And that did not go to trial. I don't know how the court would have ruled on it, because the content was pretty X-rated and inappropriate, and it really didn't have anything to do with the conduct of city business. Most city attorneys said, yeah, I wouldn't have released that because there was nothing about city business. But the fact that he was doing it while he was supposed to be acting in his elected capacity, the city attorney, and quite frankly, we will almost always err on the side of releasing the document versus not releasing it. And the reason is because there are big monetary fines with the Public Records Act, unlike the OPMA. And it's a daily fine up to $100 a day, and each piece of paper is a document. So it can get very, very expensive. You guys really won't have many things, because a lot of what you're doing are preliminary. Most citizens are going to care about your recommendation, which is your report that goes forward. So we'll get Public Records Act requests for what went forward. But I just caution you, if you're doing personal business during commission meetings, I don't anticipate that to happen. But, know that it really doesn't matter what the device is. If you're in your city capacity, you should be cautious about the documents you produce. And again, a writing, although it's called a writing, there's a definition of what a writing is. It's anything. It's electronic, it's text, it's anything. So Public Records Act is quite broad. Again, the intent being transparency. Yes?
Just to add to that, is try to only use your city emails.
Yes, thank you.
For any city business, because if there is a lawsuit or someone has a public records request, mm-hmm. and you've been communicating on your Gmail account, they can then get access to your Gmail account.
Yeah.
The ABC thinks you just don't want to.
And even though oftentimes what happens is those get reviewed by a third party and then they get pulled, but the Pierce County prosecutor. I don't know if you guys remember hearing about that case, but he was sending, again, it was kind of salacious stuff that he was sending while he, during work hours, on his private computer. And he tried to protect that, but some of it did have to do with the conduct of city business. And so it got out. So, it, you know, and his argument was, and all the city attorneys were like, you're going to lose that one, buddy, was, it's on my own laptop. It's like, doesn't matter. If you're conducting city business, it could be a public record. So so it does all sound very, very scary. And I said I wasn't going to be scary, so I apologize for that. But no, again, I've been doing this, like I said, 36 years. I've never seen a planning commission named in a lawsuit, brought up in a lawsuit, in any kind of trouble. So we're just, as Mayor Rob said, really grateful that you guys are volunteering. I'll say very briefly, it seems like Scott's had some experience in this as vice chair or in your acting chair capacity, but when you are conducting business, Robert's Rules of Order apply. Now, it is the most confusing book you could ever read. Never open it. Really, the only thing you need to know is, much like the chair asked you today, is that when you conduct business, there has to be a motion, a second, and a vote on it. And you are governed by majority vote. You need to have a quorum to have the meeting, and then you need majority vote for the main motion. Now, what if, let's say, James makes a motion, and Heather, let's say you like it, but it's just a little off, you know, saying, you know, I can support that, James, but instead of allowing one tiny home per radius of 10, you know, acres, I think it should be one per radius of 20 acres. I don't know. I'm just making this up. So you can make a motion to amend the main motion. And once you've made that motion to amend, the amendment motion takes precedent. And you need to get a second, or there's no debate or discussion or vote on it. But let's say that Olivia or Scott decides to second Heather's motion to amend James's main motion. Then the chair would call for a vote on the amended motion first, and if, or on the amendment, and if it passes, then there'll be a vote on the main motion. Now, again, these are rules that help you conduct business in a very orderly fashion. I have never seen a commission's action reversed for not properly following Robert's Rules of Order. You oftentimes hear things about, what about a friendly amendment? There really isn't such a thing under Robert's Rules, but the reality is, if the motion maker, if James goes, yeah, I really think it should have been 20, not 10, I'm going to change my motion, you're going to be okay to vote in that fashion. So, again, it's... they are applicable, but at the end of the day, all you need to know is motion, second, vote, and you can amend the main motion. I really think it's dysfunctional. Some boards, I've seen it done, and bodies use Robert's Rules of Order. I'm not going to tell you how to, but to be disruptive to the group. And your goal really should be to get an agreement and a recommendation that you feel good about that you can take up to the full city council. It shouldn't be to circumvent the work of the group. So that's really how I hope you will use those Robert Rules of Order. So that's all I really wanted to cover tonight. I think I've gone a little over my 20 minutes, but we've gone over the Open Public Meetings Act. We've gone over the three branches of government and how normally you're acting in a legislative capacity. So talk freely to all your citizens, get their feedback. You'll know when you're in a quasi-judicial, which is rare, but when you're putting your black robe on and you're a judge all of a sudden instead of a legislature, we'll let you know. And then we also talked a little bit about the Public Records Act and Robert's Rules of Order. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. But if you don't have them tonight, I'll be around in the future to help you out.
Any questions for the city attorney?
Yeah. Well, good luck. I'm going to excuse myself also, but good luck, and I trust you guys will be great for the city, so thank you again.
Thank you. All right. So this is just a very brief overview of kind of the context that you are working in as planning commissioners, the types of things that we'll be looking at in the context of the Growth Management Act or Comprehensive Planning System. So that's the world that Planning Commission works in within Washington. You're not actually reviewing development projects. regulations like noise regulations or leash laws or things like that. You're looking at development. And so I've got just a very quick PowerPoint that I want to go over with you to use the
lights
that the Borough Management Act. Oh, sure, yeah. At some point, we will have a better projector. Sorry, it's a little fuzzy. It's just a low quality projector. Yeah. So, the overall context of planning in Washington is the Growth Management Act. So, that was an act passed by the legislature back in 1990 as a response to sprawl. People were seeing really rapid development going out into rural areas, uncoordinated, with a lot of impacts in terms of transportation and use of the land. And so the Growth Management Act was passed as a planning tool, and it had a number of goals relating to transportation, affordable housing, various land use goals. But the core of it came down to preserving urban areas, or keeping growth within urban areas, within what we call an urban growth boundary or urban growth area, to protect the rural areas and resource areas outside of that, so that the urban areas don't just continue to sprawl over the landscape. With that also is the requirement to prepare comprehensive plans. So that's the guiding document for the future growth of the city. And I'll go into those chapters of the comprehensive plan in the second year. One of the key factors is that comprehensive plan elements and then also your development regulations have to be consistent. You can't establish a goal in the comprehensive plan to have a lot of low density residential development and then wind up with a lot of high density residential development in your zoning code in the same area. They have to be consistent. And your comprehensive plan is that guiding document. We're required to update our comprehensive plan every 8 years under the Growth Management Act, and that's for a couple of purposes. One of them is you just have to keep current with updates to relevant state regulations. So the Growth Management Act, Shoreland Management Act, State Environmental Policy Act, those are your big ones, but then any additional legislative updates that affect development. The other big thing is that you have to show that you've got capacity within your land use designations to accommodate your growth targets for employment growth and residential growth. So those growth targets are established at the county level in coordination with the cities. And those growth targets are, we've always understood them as floors. You have to make sure that you accommodate at least that much growth, or have the land to accommodate at least that much growth. So having a current comprehensive plan is really critical for grant eligibility. Most state grants require an up-to-date comprehensive plan in order to be eligible for those grants. And those are really big transportation and infrastructure grants that we rely on with that. So you're involved in the comprehensive plan. That's one of the primary roles of the Planning Commission. You'll be reviewing updates to the comprehensive plan and then the associated development regulations that implement. So just a very brief overview of the primary required elements of our comp plan. The land use element is the key element. That's where we're establishing land use designations. So where commercial areas are, where residential areas are, industrial, and compatibilities between those types of uses. It establishes the densities for those, and then based on that, establishes future population growth estimates. Critical areas element, it's to kind of as it sounds, it's for the protection of critical areas, including wetlands, streams, flooded areas, stormwater management, geological hazards, and then we've mapped the approximate location of those critical areas in that element. The more refined mapping takes place upon development application. Housing element, it's where we're identifying different types of housing within the city. Making sure that we're planning for all economic segments of the population, addressing affordability, addressing a variety of housing types to make sure that we're meeting the needs of diverse ages and diverse family types. Transportation element, this is one of our big important ones. This implements the land use element in that you have to ensure that you've got the infrastructure to support the densities and the land uses that your land use element is planning for.
So it includes forecasts of traffic based on those land use assumptions. You're establishing levels of service standards for your intersections and your roadways. When you go below which, you need to address the projects. And you're identifying proposed actions to address those deficiencies. And that's in the form of a transportation improvement plan, that's your TIP. Capital facilities addresses exactly that, the facilities that serve that development. So your water systems, your sewer systems, stormwater, et cetera, as well as more of the municipal resources, such as our buildings, schools, et cetera. And again, we're establishing levels of service for those facilities. And when we go below those levels of service, that shows us we've got a project that we need to do. And we address those on our capital improvement plan and our capital facilities level for those things. Utilities development, it's a little bit of a misleading name. This is how the growth management established it. It doesn't address your typical utilities like your sewer or water. These are more your franchise utilities, your electric, telecommunication lines, natural gas lines, often that are provided by other agencies. Parks and open space. Parks and open space element is our guiding plan as or how we develop our parks and recreation features for our community. And just like the other elements, you're identifying the inventory, you're establishing levels of service, how many ball fields do we want for a certain level of population, and putting together projects on a 20-year or a 6-year capital improvement plan to address those deficiencies. And economic development element, that's where you're establishing your goals and policies on how do you want to grow and foster the types of development, particularly business growth, of the types of industries that you're looking for within the community. Shoreline element, through that picture, and just because I thought it would look really nice tonight. Our shorelines here look quite independent. But that's regulating development along our shorelines, which are our rivers, you can see here. Those are implemented in our shoreline use regulations that get along with specific. We've got two additional comp plan elements that are optional. These are not required under the Growth Management Act, but we found them important for various reasons. We've got an energy and sustainability element. And that guides our actions, our decision making, that reduces our environmental impacts on things like energy use, resource conservation, things like that. Having that element helps us with eligibility for a lot of grants. So it's a useful tool. And then likewise, we have a natural resources element. Cities are not required to have that, counties are. But in the past, we've established that we have that to designate certain agricultural lands surrounding the city to ensure that we're adequately buffered and viability of those uses. So that's your comp plan, that's your guiding overall document on how you want to grow, and that's a goal and policy basis. Those are all kind of broad statements of this is how we want to grow. From there, you go into your development regulations, which is in your municipal code, and that's the tools of implementing your comprehensive plan. So, again, it has to be consistent with the comprehensive plan. That's one of the key things, because it is the tool to implement what you say you want to do. It's also the basis for review and approval of development projects. So when a residential subdivision comes in, we can't arbitrarily say, oh, we don't like that. We don't want houses of that style. We have to have specific regulations that describe what is and what is not allowed. And those regulations have to be consistent with policies. And just as with the comprehensive plan, you are the primary body for making recommendations to the City Council on updates to those development regulations. So just a very quick summary of the primary chapters within our municipal code that relate to development of critical areas, State Environmental Policy Act review, floodplain, shorelines, zoning. You can see the list there, I don't need to recite the whole thing. But you will be involved in just about all those over the course of your time here. You'll be looking at stormwater tonight. So the primary place to go for this is our website, northbendwater.gov. And underneath the Community and Economic Development page, you'll find our comprehensive plan. You'll find all those chapters. Our municipal code is likewise on there, and it'll be just a direct link to the municipal code.
just to give you a sense of heads up here, comp plan, again, will be starting into the work that will progress throughout this year and next year. We've got a major update, and remember every 8 years we're required to do a major update to our comprehensive plan. That's actually due in 2023. And so we have a lot of work to do to get ready for that. And the first part of that is the land use element, because that again establishes all of our development assumptions that are other elements that we're reliant on, like the transportation element, our parks element. We need to know our population estimates for the traffic forecasts and other things based on that land use element. So we'll be looking at that this year. One of the primary things that we want to do within that is the corridor along North Bend Way. It's always been a little bit of a mishmash, and one of the ideas that we have is to do a form-based code, and that's a form-based code and a complete streets plan for North Bend Way. What that is instead of prescribing zoning on what's called including zoning, where you're describing uses that are allowed and considered compatible with each other, instead of prescribing the exact use, you're looking at the exterior of the building and the impacts to adjacent properties. So you're looking at how's the building designed, what's its relationship to the street and the sidewalk, and if you get that right, it doesn't necessarily matter so much what's happening within the building. Particularly as our society evolves away from kind of heavy industrial uses that have a lot of direct impacts of pollution and noise and whatnot. So the form-based code amendments, we'll be looking at flood regulations in the near future. We've got FEMA is about to adopt a new flood insurance rate map. So we'll be bringing that to you here in the near term. Parking regulations, lighting regulations, sign regulations. We have a big list of wants for this year, and we'll try to get through as much of that as we can, but just a heads up that we're not going to get to all of this. It's just not possible with the amount of time that we've got with you guys and the staff time. So this is our wish list, and we'll try to knock off as many of these as we can.
The sign regulations are probably going to get up on the priority list, I imagine.
Yeah, so we do have some updates that we need to do there to be compliant with actually some Supreme Court cases. Under the likely coming soon, you'll see a lot of DAs. That's a development agreement. And a development agreement is a specific contractual agreement with a property owner that addresses something that's outside of the context of just full compliance with the municipal code. So in often cases, there's some public benefit to doing something aside from just follow the code. For example, this development agreement, actually one of the earlier ones that you will see is next meeting, the very next meeting, we'll be looking at an amendment to a development agreement for, it's called the Miller Property or Bendigo Property LLC. They're going to be doing a ball fields project. And that ball fields project, in order for it to happen, they don't have the ability to hook the sewer until a utility local improvement district is formed and bring sewer to that area of town. But we'd like to see the economic benefit of having that ball fields project in place. So this development agreement allows them to get started on that, using porta potties as a temporary measure until that sewer line is constructed. For just the ball fields, there's a second phase of the project that is more expensive, that lower line of the sewer. But that's just an example of the context of the development agreement. So you see that there's quite a few of them that are being considered in the coming year. So we plugged in the first quarter Planning Commission meeting dates. We don't want to go any further than that because it gets a little too squirrely trying to predict that far out. But this gives you an idea of what's coming for the next couple of months. So any questions or thoughts on that?
Seven, which is introduction to amendments to stormwater regulations. And I think we'll have you do your presentation first, and Mike, if you want to ask.
Sure.
Come back.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Okay. Thanks very much, Chair Scott. My name is Mark Rigos. For those of you, I know all, well, several of you fairly well, and then welcome to the Planning Commission here. Let's first talk about who, what, where, when, why, how of what we're doing. Storm drainage, also called storm water runoff or storm water, it's all interchangeable. It's a good night to talk about it. So Holy River's at flood phase two right now, and it goes ratchets up from 1 to 5, and I kind of monitor that for the city. I'm also the city of North Bend's emergency manager. My background, so first off, who? I've worked at the city of North Bend for 5.5 years. I was a public works director for 4 years, and then I was promoted about a year and a half ago by the mayor and outgoing Londi Lindell to interim city administrator last year. So I took that role for a little over a year, and I've stepped back to public works director for timing and circumstances. And I'm planning to be here for a long time. So that's some of my background at the city. Let's see, my experience is in education. I have a civil engineering degree from WSU, go Cougs, in the 90s, and a biology degree from WSU as well, and also an MBA. I have designed, and I'm a licensed civil engineer. I got my professional engineering license from the state of Washington in 2001. I've designed storm drainage facilities in probably every jurisdiction in King County. I've spent a lot of time in the private sector. I'm very confident in my skills. It's my favorite utility, stormwater. I like it better than water, sewer, roads, parks, electricity, and I just like it better. Stormwater is really fascinating to me. So I'm here to be a resource for you. If you ever have questions on stormwater, I'm your guy. I know the stuff as well as anybody east of Bellevue, honestly. Designed it, engineered it, managed it, maintained it, operated it, I know it well. So I answered who, what is storm drainage, what are some of the things that it involves? It's collection systems, conveyance systems, water quality treatment systems, detention systems, retention systems, outfall systems. Those are some of the components of storm drainage. Where we're doing this, or why this surface water design manual, well, there was the King County 1979 manual, there's the 1990 manual, the 1998 manual, the 2005, the 2009, and now the 2016. Myself and Brian Tucker here, who's also city staff, has a ton of experience as well, and he can fill in any gaps I missed. We've designed storm drainage facilities to all of those manuals, and I have about 25 years of experience in doing that. So we're following these core requirements that are laid out in about literally a 1,000-page booklet for those collection, conveyance, water quality, detention. Any new project that comes into the city, if it's forest or farm, and an applicant wants to convert it to roads or homes, there's going to be an increase in impervious area. There's less area for that runoff to soak into the ground, and it creates stormwater runoff. So what this impacts is adjacent properties. And so from an erosion standpoint, landslide standpoint, sedimentation, property damage, flooding, etc., we want to make sure that those impacts are mitigated to a certain manual. And that manual has been the King County 2009 manual for at least 10 years, 9 years, whatever it's been. And now we're proposing staff are to move towards the King County 2016 surface water design manual. So again, it's erosion, sedimentation, landslides, flooding, etc. This impacts private development projects. I touched on that a little bit. It also impacts capital projects. So we receive taxes, the city does, to build roundabouts, to build right turn lanes, etc. In the roundabout, you've probably seen there's a bunch of catch basins around the roundabout, but not actually functioning that well right now because the final pavement lift has not been built yet. But once it is laid, that asphalt, then all that runoff in the gutters is going to flow towards the catch basins, and we have a compost filter for water quality treatment, then we have an outfall system, and away that water goes. So we use it for private development projects and capital projects. 99% of our infrastructure doesn't meet the current surface water design manual because it's older. King County infrastructure is built in the 50s or 60s or 70s. If you go out to Silver Creek neighborhood, it's an older neighborhood, There's no collection, there's no conveyance, there's no detention, there's no water quality treatment. The first King County Surface Water Design Manual didn't come out until 1979, and all those houses were built in the 1950s. That's one of the reasons that the pavement's not in good shape out there, is because that water just sits on the road. It's not ground, so the water is supposed to sheet flow off and then go into pipes and ditches and so forth. So that's that's, you know, capital projects and private development projects are what we're talking about. How this works in a project, whether it's a capital or a private development project, there'll be a surveyor that will determine where the property lines are, will determine the lay of the land. It's called a topographical survey. And then a civil engineer will take that boundary and topographical survey, draw on the road, draw on homes, the plat, the commercial project, wherever it is, and then determine where the storm drainage facilities need to be, the catch basins, the piping, the pond, the bioinfiltration spills, etc. So that's what a civil engineer will use as the 2016 manual versus the 2009 manual. Not a particularly large difference between the two manuals. The only real difference is there's an extra core requirement in the 2016 manual that has a flow control BMP section of best management practice. So that could be an additional requirement in the development to provide dry wells or an infiltration trench or a dispersion trench. So it's just another way of mitigating that runoff onto the downstream property owners so they don't feel it as much. Ideally, they're discharging into the city, the public storm drainage system, rather than shunting that water on private property. So there's something called common enemy doctrine where, and this is also a core requirement, where you have to discharge that stormwater at the natural location, because a developer or an applicant can't collect all that stormwater and then pick it up and move it three properties over. He or she's got to discharge it where it naturally flows. So that's the type of thing that Brian and some of my staff look at when these developments are being submitted to the city. So we talked about that one change was the flow control BMP section core requirement. I think another change was not allowing porous concrete. And when I worked in Newcastle, before I got there, they added a bunch of porous concrete, which is different than permeable pavement. So porous concrete is you know, poured out of a cement truck and there's a lot of voids in it, and in shady environments it will literally turn green with algae and moss in a couple of years and become really slick, and it's no fun and it's very expensive to rip out. Permeable pavements doesn't typically turn that green and slippery and so forth. A couple recent neighborhoods that have been built have some pervious pavement. And that can work really well if you've got soils that infiltrate below that pavement, which North Bend does have. Unlike a lot of cities in King County, Bellevue and Newcastle, Issaquah, it's very silty soils underneath. There are clay soils and so forth. So we have that advantage up here in North Bend. So let's see, I talked about, did I miss who, what, where, when, why? Oh, when. So it's a four-step process. This is the second step. The first step was the city council meeting recently where we just introduced that. I think there might have been one or two public comments. Step two is tonight, kind of an overview. Happy to answer, you know, any questions from you guys tonight. Step three is, I think we're bringing this back to Planning Commission to your next meeting. And then step four is to take this to city council for approval, which would probably happen in March after your input. My recommendation is we move forward with the 2016 manual. I don't think there's any cities left in King County that are still using the 2009 manual.
Or the only one.
And some of the other cities use what's called the Washington State Department of Ecology Stormwater Management Manual. It's pretty much the same stuff. It's just a different layout. My staff is a little more familiar with the King County, and that's what City of North Bend has been using for a long time, so we'd just like to be consistent and we'll continue to roll with the King County program and move forward towards 2016. So I don't know if I missed anything, Brian, or?
No, I think you covered it very well. You know, we've been utilizing the 2009, as Marcus already let you guys know, and the 2009 is outdated. It is no longer in compliance or in equivalency with the Department of Ecology Stormwater Regulations. So that is another one of the reasons we want to update to the 2016, so that we are in equivalency with ecology regulations.
Quick question about it. Just on a simplified level, the code, without just reading the 1,000-page the code that we did read here that you guys sent out, the design manual update with the ordinance on it, is that more of an adder to that manual, or is this taking parts of that manual and putting them in our code specifically?
Which sections?
The whole thing in general, right? The changes you made look like they were saying, most of the changes saying we're referencing to the newest one, not to 2009. But this whole section that we saw, the 43 pages here, are these excerpts from that manual, or is this additional to the manual that Mark Ben is doing specifically?
Oh, great question. So, we went through the different code provisions referencing the stormwater manual. What we discovered is, we had outdated definitions, so we updated those definitions to match the current manual.
Okay.
Second item, specifically in reference to 1416 manual adopted, there were several references to different versions of the King County Surface Water Design Manual, so we wanted to basically bring those all up to what is called the current edition of the King County Surface Water Design Manual, so that when King County comes out with another update, which they're starting to work on, we won't have to go through this entire process all over again. We'll automatically retro-approve the manual. As previously mentioned, under 1416.060 manual adopted, there are seven additional items that we did add. That were either reinforcing elements of the King County Surface Water Design Manual that we felt as though we didn't want developers to try to apply for a variance for, and those were specifically to protect our well. North Bend is one of several jurisdictions, very few jurisdictions, that actually have a well in their downtown core. The other one is City of Redmond. So what we did was, based off of information that we had received from Redmond, is we have modified some of our code provisions so that we're consistent with their standards. Specifically, the pollution generating impervious surface runoff within our critical aquifer recharge area, category one. We want to reduce the amount of heavy metals, bacteria, other elements that may go into our groundwater that could affect the numbers coming out of our well. So those changes were made in one section. There was other items that we added that were more clarification items to help see staff out as well as the development community out. So, and all in all, it was probably seven elements that we changed or that we referenced that were part of the 2016 King County
Surface.
So just North Bend Municipal Code amendments drafted.
Any other questions?
Okay. There we go. Press the documents for y'all. So there's five documents for y'all, and there's three for y'all. Okay, Mike Thomas, 1231 before, so I don't know where you're going to stand. Thanks for the excellent introduction, Mark. What I want to talk a little bit about is actually some of the intersection between wellhead protection, critical areas, and stormwater. In fact, some of the regulations you're adopting are reliant on critical areas. A great deal of North Bend is in a critical aquifer recharge area, both type 1 and type 2. The 2016 manual includes a couple extra restrictions on type 1. They're important to note, so I think it's very important that we understand the basis of what's type 1 and type 2 and how we landed at this stuff. And I also want to thank Brian and Jamie for speaking with me a little bit about that item on wellhead, the choice of following the revenue provisions, which I kind of understand were intended around Centennial to be around the 1 year time zone of the trial. There was a concept of certain time zones, how long contaminants can go to a well, and that's my understanding of how the city has defined Kara type 1 around its well. consider that the city also has other areas that are also carrier type 1, and we also have many areas that aren't served by sewer. Particular concern I have is, for example, a capital project, you need to run sewer. You have Silver Creek that doesn't have sewer, and there are other neighborhoods that don't have sewer. So what code would we have to comply to, what citizens have to comply to, for an existing neighborhood in terms of road repair, swale? There's a lot of old swale. That's stormwater management, for lack of a better term. What do you do about this? Will this have to be brought to new code? There's a tremendous amount of Cedar Falls Way right here, North Bend Way. That looks like swale and stormwater management. So what happens for really the case of running sewer for neighborhoods that don't have it? Any intersection with the 2016 code, which I think is an important question, that may considerably drive up the cost of running sewer to areas that aren't currently served by sewer. And that's a real key concern. The other thing is also around the city's desire to protect its well. And I also, and one document to attach is the current definitions. One thing I can take exception to city staff is that this represents a wellhead protection area. Nowhere in this map does it use the word wellhead protection area. It uses wellhead protection study area. So I think that's very important to note that these maps be precise and mean exactly what they say. These do define the CARAs, but they don't necessarily define the wellhead protection area. If you actually read the notes, these were taken from the city website today. The other thing is I'd also like to call to the city's attention is the Planning Commission's attention is the wellhead protection program, which is the second document. This comes from the city's 2010 water system plan, and one of the pages here actually has a map, which kind of details the zones of protection around the city's well. There's a 6-month, a 1-year, and larger radii in there. My understanding is that the city chose the 1-year radii around the centennial well. But also on the last page, I'd like to also point out the city has said there are no potential contaminant sources within the 1-year and 5-year zone of contribution at the time the well was permitted. And I think that's important. There were no sources of contamination that the city signed off on, that its professional engineer signed off on. I'm very concerned about mention of potential sources of contamination on the well, but yet this mention of this document doesn't say that there are any in this water system plan. So I'm a bit concerned about any characterization that there are contaminant sources when the city's own engineer and consultant signed off on this and submitted this as a water system plan in 2010. I am concerned that there may be efforts to change this. As the city wants to take more water from the centennial well, do they need to expand these zones? And that poses an interesting question for sewer service, for contaminant management. Think about it. The centennial well is in the second building over here. That's 300 feet from the roadway that has swale. You've got a lot of oils and hydrocarbons running off. So there's an interesting question, I think, that the city may face here with this. And also, there's a lot of attractive requirements to the development in CARA Type 1 and 2. Are these even feasible? This may make development quite difficult for anyone. May make repairs difficult, maintenance changes. So I hope the city would consider, that the Planning Commission would consider, some of these intersections with stormwater management and the critical resource areas may make it very difficult to offer sewer service, as well as to allow for feasible development and even changes to Cedar Falls Way and North Bend Way. A great deal of city is in CARA 1, so I expect to come back on the 13th, but I'd like to hear some questions really answered about, are capital projects like sewer improvement going to trigger the 2016 stormwater manual for any neighborhood that needs sewer? That's a really big concern. That's huge expense for like Silver Creek and other neighborhoods that may need sewer at some point in the future. And I hope that you would also take the time to review these documents in another time. Thank you.
Well, I'm wondering if the Category 1 wells are tested by Department of Health and Soil Health. Do you think you can see this?
Yes, good question. So the city of North Bend has a actually city limits, there's two water purveyors in North Bend city limits. One is North Bend Water, and there's also a private co-op called Salal Water Service Area. So what city regulates, we don't regulate Salal Water Service, we regulate North Bend. And we have two drinking water sources. One is Mount Si Springs, and if you look at the last page, and actually the exhibit, thanks Mike for providing it, you'll see it, there's a map of North Bend, and it's at the toe of Mount Si, and it's gorgeous, beautiful, crystal clear water. And so that is approximately 50% of our water source, depending on the season. And then approximately 50% comes from Centennial Well. And as Michael said, Centennial Wells, it's about 1,000 feet in that direction. Those are blended sources. We test those daily, and we chlorinate those. Not every water purveyor chlorinates. We do chlorinate. We test for arsenic. We test for lead. We test for coliforms. We test for, there's about 10 different various compounds that we test for. And those are submitted to Department of Ecology in Bellevue. So does that answer your question?
I had a question back on this ordinance. So some of the exhibits attached to the ordinance don't look like they have any changes to them. Like exhibits, let's see, A and B don't seem to have any changes. C looks like it has some additions and some deletions in red. And then there's a mixture of those on some of the other exhibits. So I understand the ones that have the legislative changes shown in red, those are proposed changes, but what about the exhibits that don't have changes? Are these, is this new language?
Can you answer that, Brian?
Yeah, so I think what we did was we took snippets of each code section out. So the areas with the black text are the existing, what's currently in our code. And then the areas that are highlighted in red, or I know some versions had blue, those are the changes, the actual changes to the North Bend Municipal Code.
So on exhibit A, if I were looking at our current code, not that I'm going to do this, but if I were looking at our current code, this would be the exact same language.
So to clarify, I think it's a printer problem. When we copy, it doesn't necessarily pick up the color, but if you look on like page 4 on Exhibit A, there are the edits, and they just didn't blend up in red.
Okay. Yeah, that's confusing. Okay, so maybe on the next version, I can make sure that that's correct. Because I'm just looking at a second.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do?
Often, if there's not enough red on the page, the printer won't pick it up, and it just goes black white.
Okay. So if you can figure out a way to either describe it or use yellow highlighting or something, so it's clear to not only the commission but the public in terms of what's actually changing, that would be great. So would this have been correct in the electronic version?
It should be great.
Particular section, storm drainage, what we'll receive from an applicant is a site plan or a preliminary plat map that shows where the lots are going to be, and typically there will be a tract that's maybe a set aside of conservation area that is called sometimes a native growth protection easement, NGPE, or a forested open space tract. And so what we typically require is a surveyor to survey all of the trees and show that on their site plan. And on that site plan, we'll show which trees are being significant trees are being removed and which significant trees are being preserved. And the trees that are being preserved might be in a conservation area as part of that native growth protection easement or forested open space tract. And then that is protected by city ordinance, so people can't go out there and start cut trees once those houses are built. Sometimes there are groves in the corner of the subdivision, like in Cedar Falls neighborhood, if you've been through there, there's a couple hundred homes. There's five or six tree groves of 15 to 20 trees, and I believe those are either in an NGPE, Native Growth Protection Easement, or Forest Open Space Covenant. And that's recorded, that document, ultimately the final plat map, is recorded down in King County, and everybody has access to it. And if there's people out there chainsawing or something like that, people are going to get wind of it. We can find them and so forth, because that's supposed to be a protected area.
I have a question on page 14. It is the mitigation order referencing Crystal Act, and that has been struck out. And I was just wondering what the various comments are on that. Is that captured anywhere else?
I'm reading it right now.
Or maybe there was some redundancy somewhere else in the plan.
I think that's redundant to our critical area regulations. This is my guess, I'm not familiar with what I've struck here, but we recently adopted updated critical area regulations and has that mitigation sequencing in the critical area regulations. There may have been some inconsistency here.
Yeah, that seems accurate. It's a bit odd language to have in storm drainage. Okay. And I'm happy to answer questions offline if something comes up and you just want to talk about storm drainage and developments or whatever. Give me a call.
And then our public hearing on this is at our next meeting, so there will be opportunity for public comment. And then based on what we talked about at the beginning of the meeting, we will not be expected to make a recommendation that you can, correct?
You could.
If we're ready, we can.
You could, but then just not take action until the following meeting until you see whatever corrections that you've made in time.
But if there are no, what will be with that next week? That's fine. Okay. All right. Looks like we are at number 8, which is adjournment. And it is 9:30.
You just need a gavel.
I have a gavel.
There you go.
All right.
Well, welcome aboard, everyone.
Ha, ha, ha.